Stayed in bed all morning just to pass the time. There's something wrong here, there can be no denying. One of us is changing, or maybe we just stop trying. And it's too late, baby, now it's too late. Though we really did try to make it. Something inside has died, and I can't hide, and I just can't fake it. Oh, no, no.
Carole King started playing the piano when she was four. In her teens, she landed a job as a songwriter in New York City. She would become one of the most successful songwriters and singers in American history, an inductee to both the Songwriters Hall of Fame and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. King continues to write and record. She remains active in political and environmental causes and is in Washington, D.C. today to lobby for the Northern Rockies Ecosystem Protection Act. Songwriter and singer Carole King joins me in the studio. I'm Diane Rehm. I thank you for joining us today. Carole is going to be talking about her life in and out of the music business. We'll also take your calls, your questions, comments, 1-800-433-8850, or send us your emails to drshow@wamu.org. Carole King, everybody in this studio is just so happy you're here.
Well, I'm happy too. It's great to be here.
Thank you so much. You've said that you are first, last, and always a songwriter. What is it that makes you so happy about being a songwriter?
Because of the process, writing a song is a very pure process, and you come into a room, whether it's alone or with other writers, and there's nothing, and out of nothing, something is created, and it's an amazing feeling to be part of that process of seeing something where there was nothing.
Do you think it's odd that more people knew you as a singer than a songwriter, first and foremost?
Is that true, that more people know me as a singer?
I think that your voice had such power, and really they didn't realize you had written all those songs that other people were singing until James Taylor finally encouraged you, urged you to get up there on the stage and do it yourself.
Well, yeah, I do take your point, because a lot of people still say to me, oh, I didn't know you wrote that. So, yeah, James Taylor did more than urge me. He sort of stopped short of pushing me.
How did he do that? I mean, and what was your resistance?
I had a bit of shyness about performing. I just felt like, I mean, I didn't mind performing for a small group of people, but somehow, to me, the idea of getting out on a stage and being in the spotlight was a little intimidating to me. And at the time, I was playing backup in James's band. This was, I think, in 1970, and happily playing backup in James's band. And then he'd been performing up on the roof. He always liked that song, which I co-wrote with Jerry Goffin. And one night he said, I want you to sing up on the roof tonight. I'm like, no. And he said, no, I want you to do it. And he was just insistent. And sure enough, the song before Up on the Roof, I'm like getting totally nervous. And then James introduces me with this lovely, warm introduction, listing for the people in the audience all the songs that I had written that were their favorites. And by the time he finished his introduction, I got such a warm welcome from the audience that I wasn't really intimidated. I felt, okay, they must like my songs, so maybe they'll like this one.
Now, did that kind of stage shyness on your part continue, or did that first time sort of do it?
It continued, and really the time that broke it completely, and I would say permanently. The experience was at the Troubadour, a club in Los Angeles in 1971. The year the Tapestry came out, James was headlining, and I was going to be his opening act. So we get to the club, and there's just lines around the block wanting to get in to hear James. So I get out there in my long dress that I made myself, and I say, good evening, and I take a sip of water, and then I sit down at the piano, and I play my first song. When I'm playing, even then, I could just say, okay, I'm playing the song. That was more comfortable for me. At the end of the song, I say, thank you very much. I take my sip of water and think, okay, I better get to the next song. So I play the next song. And then I'm about to get to the third song, and at this point, my theatrical sense tells me, I have to say something to these people and acknowledge that they are here. So I'm about to open up my mouth and say something timidly when this voice comes out over the loudspeaker, a disembodied voice saying, Carol, we hate to do this, but we just want to ask everybody to leave the club in an orderly fashion. There's probably no truth to it, but there was a rumor that there was a bomb here. And the first thing that pops into my head is, oh, my God, as long as it isn't me. Which made everybody laugh and sort of diffused the moment. And I realized that I didn't have to worry about what to say. I just needed to be myself.
That is just an extraordinary story. And I can surely understand why it changed the way you were thinking about yourself.
I feel the earth.
Still enjoy performing on tour?
I enjoy performing. It's the on tour part that sometimes is problematic. But
why?
Yes, I do.
Why?
Because, first of all, it means I have to be someplace at a certain time, which is planned way in advance. Second of all, it's an enormous responsibility to be up on stage every night, night after night. And for me also to try to find the freshness in performing what is, you know, more or less the same show night after night. That said, I really enjoy it. And I have recently reconnected with performing again this year. And I'm going to go out on tour later this year.
That's terrific. And, of course, you've got a new album. But we're going to hear for just a few moments another selection from Tapestry.
So far away, doesn't anybody stay in one place anymore? It would be so fine to see your face at my door. It doesn't help to know you're just time away. Long ago I reached for you and
you know, I found myself as I was reading about your not particularly caring to be on tour, whether just being away from your home, being away from the people, the objects, the surroundings you love, so far away made it harder for you.
It's not being away from my home because I have come to consider the world my home.
Good for you.
It's being away from people I love that You know, that's actually, that was the trigger for So Far Away when I wrote it in 1970. I think I wrote it in 70. I was married to Charlie Larkey, my bass player, and at the time, we performed together most of the time, but I was on tour with James, and he was at home, so I wrote So Far Away with that in mind.
And that was hard for you when you were away from him. Was it hard for him?
Sure. I mean, I think it's hard for everybody. I think about the people over in Iraq now, how hard that must be for them and their families. It's just such a courageous thing when people do that.
Nothing else to do but close my mind. You're so far away. Doesn't anybody stay in one place anymore? It would be so fine to see your face at my door. And it doesn't help to know you're so far away.
Yeah. I feel as though our audience, Carole King, is very, very nearby. There are many people on the phones who'd like to talk with you. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, here's some more music, more from Carole King and you. Singer and songwriter Carole King is with me. We are hearing her music and hearing her lovely voice as she speaks about lots of issues that concern her, concern all of us. And we'll take your calls in just a few moments, 1-800-433-8850, or if you'd like to send us an email, drshow@wamu.org. Carole, you've written for just about everybody, Aretha Franklin, James Taylor, Celine Dion, even the Monkees. I mean, is it a different process for you to be writing a song for someone else as opposed to one you know you're going to perform yourself?
It is somewhat different. Most of the songs I perform myself actually, or often, those songs have been written for other people anyway. I'll give you examples of both. Say, for Aretha Franklin, you know, if I know I'm writing for her, I've got her voice in my head, and I'm thinking of the kind of music that she sings. You know, for Celine Dion, the same thing. And the interesting thing is both of these women have ranges well beyond my own. So some of the demos, you know, I'm just croaking away in ranges I shouldn't be singing in. And also I co-write. So the lyricist, like Jerry Goffin, for example, on Natural Woman, you know, this is a man writing one of the great all-time You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman songs. So he obviously was thinking in her head. On my own, a song like So Far Away, or a song on Love Makes the World, the song Safe Again, the Love Makes the World being my most recent album, those songs really just came. They just sort of dropped in as I was sitting at a piano, at least the beginnings of them did. Then the craft took over. But so it is, I wasn't thinking of who that song was going to be for. I was just letting it happen.
Looking out on the morning rain, I used to feel uninspired. And when I knew I'd have to face another day, Lord, it made me feel so
You wrote this for Aretha Franklin. How did that come about?
Well, I wrote it for Aretha, but the version that you're playing is the version from Tapestry, which was me singing it. It started with me singing it. The original demo was me singing it so Aretha could hear the song. Then there was Aretha's version. Then there was me recording my version following Aretha's version. And actually, on my latest album, Love Makes the World, there's a comparable situation with Celine Dion and the song The Reason, which really has a great story. We can talk about it now or later, whatever you like.
Talk about it now.
All right. You talked about the process of writing and creating something out of nothing. I went to a castle that Miles Copeland, Sting's former manager, has that he invites songwriters to come to, and he groups us together in groups of three. And says, you got to write a song, whatever, for whatever purpose. It can be for any artist, anything. Just the mission is you've got to write a song. Miles' interest was to have at least one of his writers so that he has part of the publishing, which is fair enough. So this song, The Reason, that was the very first song that I ever wrote at my first visit to the castle with Mark Hudson and Greg Wells. Greg, by the way, has since become my son-in-law. He's married to my daughter, Louise Goffin, so the castle has given me many things. But the song, The Reason, we sat down to write for Aerosmith because Mark is a producer and friend of Aerosmith. So we write this screaming, rocking song, You Are the Reason, right? Mark decides I'm the one to sing it. Why, I don't know. He's the one with the rocking voice. So we do this screaming demo in about 2 hours. and we figure, okay, this is going to go to Aerosmith. And we had the best time. I mean, a bunch of people just came in and sang background, and Mark did all the high notes, which I couldn't reach. Okay, so now we find out that the song has been shown not to Aerosmith, but to Celine Dion, and she loved it. So she records the song. She's recording it in England, I think. She recorded it in England with, in Great Britain, UK, whatever you call it, with George Martin producing. They invite me to come and play on it and sing on it, so I did that, which was great. So now there's version two. But I thought, you know, people kept saying to me, why don't you put out your demo? It's so soulful. We couldn't put it out because sonically it just was impossible. It wasn't recorded under circumstances that would allow it to sound good. Mm. It has the feeling. So the mission was to try to capture the feeling. Aww. And on that album, Love Makes the World, my version of The Reason, as close to what we could get to the original demo. So that song just went through an amazing journey.
Carol, how did it all start for you? I said in the opening that you began playing the piano at age 4, but were you singing with yourself? Were your parents encouraging you? What was going on?
My parents both encouraged me. My mom had had piano lessons but didn't have aptitude. Her aptitude was in theater. My dad never had lessons, but he had some musical aptitude and an ear. Whatever, I got the best of it. There was a piano in my home. I feel so lucky that there was a piano in my home. And I just started doinking around on it. And my dad would, you know, test me which note is which, and we'd just have a lot of fun with it. But, yeah, I just started to play and pick out tunes and sing, and, you know, it gradually evolved. And I got, my mom gave me lessons, and then I took lessons outside of the home. And I didn't have the discipline to become a classical pianist or singer. I didn't have that, like, really work hard every day on it. And I wanted it to be fun first, not work. And it was work, but it was also fun, and we kept it that way.
Was it primarily piano, or was there voice as well from those early ages?
I studied piano early. I studied voice a little later on, but I didn't find it mostly applied to the style I wanted to sing, except as it related to, you know, the ability, that, like, for example, use of diaphragm to project. That's really key. And when I sing, like right now I'm talking in my normal voice, if I switch to a voice where I'm using my diaphragm, I'm speaking from a different place. And that's the place that I sing from. You have to, or you can't sustain that with your physical body.
When you perform and you're singing, say, for an hour or an hour and a half at a time, does that diaphragm support you sufficiently so you don't come off feeling as though you're struggling?
Yes, it does, absolutely. And that's one of the best things I got out of the vocal training. I also find that as I get older, I really have to work up to the vocal strength. I didn't used to have to, you know, I really need to sing a little bit every day in order to keep my vocal strength up for singing.
So you're exercising your,
yes,
vocal cords every single day.
Yes.
Makes sense.
Yes.
You know, Tapestry, the album we've been playing from, continues to sell some 30 years after its release. It's included near the top of every list of best albums of all time. Did you have any idea this was going to happen?
Nope. Boggles my mind.
Does it really?
Yeah, I understand why. People do tell me why, but no, I had no idea at the time. I did then what I do today in all areas of my life. I do what feels right and hope it touches people.
Well, this song certainly touches a lot of people.
And trouble.
Carole King, I have a sense that you've got lots of friends.
Apparently I do.
I mean, really, really good friends on whom you can call.
Oh, I do. I do.
Anytime, day or night.
I don't think of it as lots because, you know, the people that I know that I can call upon are very close to me. But I guess I do, and I'm very, very lucky.
What moved you to write this song?
That's one of those that just dropped in.
Really?
I was sitting at a piano, heavily under the influence of James Taylor, because I was touring with him and singing with him, and his voice was in my head. But when I sat down to the piano, that song just came, and I've always considered it a gift, and I'm glad it came through me. I can't tell you how glad I am it came through me, but it has touched a lot of people.
To see you again, winter, spring, summer, or fall, all you have to do is call, and I'll be there. Yes, I will. Now, ain't it good to know when people can be so cold?
Carol, I want to know about the background music here.
The background music?
Yeah, the piano.
Oh. Well, Charlie Larkey is on bass.
Charlie Larkey's on bass.
Playing the acoustic, upright, actual big bass.
Okay.
And a string quartet.
It's marvelous.
Yeah. One of the members of that quartet, if I remember correctly, David Campbell, is the father of Beck, the recording artist Beck, this generation's, artist.
You know, it's fascinating to me because I understand that when the Beatles came to town, they wanted to be like you. And
I've heard that, yeah.
Extraordinary.
They were, and then some.
At 24 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And, of course, Carole King is our very special guest this morning. And let's open the phones now and try to get in as many calls, emails as we can. Let's go first to Woodmere, Ohio. Good morning, Sharon. You're on the air.
Good morning. Hi, Miss King. I'm on the younger side of the baby boomers, but I'm old enough to remember your songs. You started so young, you might not be that much older than I am. But I won a talent show singing when I was 12 years old, singing You've Got a Friend. Can you hear it?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I just love that song. I absolutely adore it. Thank you. I grew up to major in music. I have a doctorate in music, and I write mostly religious songs at this point, you know, children's songs. But I just loved your music. It's Too Late. It just reminds me of when I was in junior high school. And just thank you for your songs. And as I'm sitting here listening to the show, just finding out more and more about how prolific you really are, it's just mind-boggling.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for calling.
Thanks, Sharon.
That's a great comment. Here's one from Mara, who says, when I was a little girl, my father took me on my first date to see a performance of Really Rosie. Ever since then, it's held great sentimental value, and the album has always been one of my favorites, led me to become a real fan of Ms. King's. I was hoping she could talk a little bit about how she came to be involved in the production of Really Rosie and her experiences. And, of course, that was with Maurice Sendak.
Right.
One of my great heroes.
And mine as well. Maurice Sendak's producer, I think, approached my then manager, Lou Adler, and said that Maurice had these nutshell books that became some of the songs in the Really Rosie collection. And Maurice wanted them set to music, and would I want to do it? And I did. And he wrote a ton more, you know, little poems. And it was really, really easy for me. Those lyrics, when I put them up on the piano stand, just formed themselves into little melodies as I looked at them. It was just the easiest thing. A, alligators all around. B, bursting balloons.
Do more.
C, catching colds, which I have. D, doing dishes. And, of course, on that album, two of my daughters sing the little kids' parts, Louise Goffin and Sherry Goffin, who is now Sherry Goffin Condor, who made kids' albums of her own. She, if you go to Sugar Beats, Sugar, SugarBeats.com, you'll see all these albums that she made for children with her kids.
What an extraordinarily musical family you have created, Carol King. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, more of your calls, your email, and music.
Tonight you're mine completely. You give your love so sweet.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, actor and comic Russell Brand.
I think you have to feel embarrassment to vanquish it, you know? I mean, like, something embarrassing will happen to me, and I think, right, never tell anyone about that. And then the next impulse is, that means it's funny, tell everyone.
Russell Brand talks about his outrageous behavior and comedy on the next Fresh Air.
Is a place that I know, where I can find shelter from a hunger and cold, and the sweet taste in is so easily found.
Carol King, I know that your move to Idaho sparked an interest in environmental causes. Tell us, I know you're here to speak about the Northern Rockies Ecosystem Protection Act. Talk about what that would do.
Right, that's what actually brings me to D.C. This bill would actually protect the Northern Rockies ecosystem, so its name is actually what it would do. And what it basically would do is take the roadless lands that are now still wilderness but are now in danger of having roads and are actually having roads built into them, which takes them out of wilderness. We want to take the roadless areas and designate them as wilderness. for so many reasons. For one thing, it costs the taxpayers money to build those roads into the national forests, and then the timber that they sell on the as a result of building the road is about a tenth of what it costs to build the road. So it's costing the taxpayers money. The other reason is for accessibility for people to get to a wilderness like this Northern Rockies. It's very special and needs to be kept. So much of it is open to the public for, you know, not only to the public, but to industry. It's all open to the public. So many of it is open to industry and is being ruined by industry. We want to preserve some wilderness so it's there for people, for our grandchildren. That's been said so often, it's trite. The other thing is that there's a people in the region are concerned about jobs. I think that the industries that benefit from destroying this wilderness feed that fear in people that, you know, jobs are gone and aren't going to come back. The truth is that the future, the economic future in these regions lies in the livability, that people in cities who want to move to a more livable area would be attracted to live in this region. And if we don't protect these wilderness areas, there won't be any reason for people to want to be there.
To whom are you speaking while you're here?
I'm speaking to bipartisan House members and senators. And the bill was introduced by the Republican from Connecticut, Christopher Shays. His co-lead on that is Carolyn Maloney, the Democrat from New York. We want to get a bill going in the Senate. We have 178 co-sponsors in the House. With Shays, it's 179, meaning that we are 39 short of a majority. But there's more to it than that. And sometimes I find myself wishing I could get the Republicans and the Democrats in one room, sing You've Got a Friend to them, and have them go out holding hands.
I was going to say you could use your music to make sure this happens. What kind of reception have you gotten?
It's a really great reception. I mean, amazingly, we have this great number of co-sponsors in the House. In the Senate, people are looking at it. There are problems that are more in people's faces and more threatening to their lives today. So it takes a seat just under in people's minds. And I get that. I think jobs and health care are probably at the top of people's lists, and bringing those people home from Iraq and all over the world, you know, when possible, is just at the top of people's lists. But protecting the environment, I mean, this protects our air. It protects our water. Farmers depend on that water that this watershed protects. So it's not like these things are less important. They're just, you know, kind of under the radar, and I'm trying to keep it on the radar along with everything else. It's just this is the one I personally know about and can speak to the issues in more detail.
Let's go to Orem, Utah. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Diane and Carol. Nice to speak to the both of you.
Thank you.
Hi, Scott.
Hi, Carol. You know, I grew up listening to your music, and it still inspires me as a songwriter. So my question is, after you've written thousands of songs, what things do you do to continue to summon up your creative muse?
I'm so glad you asked that. I mean, actually, part of my environmental and political work is that, because I write down my thoughts and my ideas and I communicate. And songwriting really is a form of communication. But don't fret. I'm not giving up my songwriting. I think they feed each other. I think
do
I need
you?
Both. Yes.
Uh-huh. Well, this new album called Love Makes the World must have had some inspiration from what's going on in the world.
One song in it actually did, the song called Safe Again. That was one of those songs. I'll actually get around to the title song, but the song called Safe Again was one of those songs that dropped in, and that's something I hope people will listen to. I don't know if we have it here, but the title song, Love Makes the World, was a funny collaboration. It was absolutely delightful. I worked with these two guys who were at the time under 30. They live in New York, and they're kind of urban-minded. They you know, got the yo, and they wear the clothes and the hip-hop. And they had the sequenced groove, the drum groove that you hear. And they presented me with the lyric. There was trouble in my mind tonight. Something inside didn't feel quite right. Then I saw your face in the moonlight. And I'm like, okay, how does this fit with me? Well, we made it work, and this is what it sounds like.
When the snowfall hit Cold City, it was hard to commit. You were out there looking for the perfect fit, and I was right beside you. Nothing real comes overnight. You weren't sure if it felt right, but sometimes...
Yeah, so you heard that last little bit with the, you know, last winter when the snowfall hit. I mean, that's what we did to try to make it more musical. And I had the most fun writing with these two guys that I've had in a long time.
I mean, there's a certain sense of rap in there.
Yeah.
That's different for you.
It is. Sam Hollander and Dave Schomer are the guys' names, and they have this sense of hip-hop rhythm, and I love the internal rhymes and the playing with the rhythms about it. The only thing I don't like about it is a negative message, and I think that, you know, there is room for negative messages in the world because people need to express their anger, but it's not for me to do that. It's not my mission to do that. And I would never censor people. I just would hope that there would be more positive messages.
Carol, I've heard you say now several times that songs just drop in. What does that mean?
I liken it to something that you might do or anybody might do. If you're writing a letter and you don't know what to say, and suddenly you find yourself writing and it's coming out of the pen onto the paper, that's the phenomenon, only it's happening to me on a piano and often the same way with a pen and paper or a computer, same thing. If I'm typing at a keyboard, I may not know what I'm going to say, and suddenly it comes out. That's the phenomenon, and everybody probably has experienced it. And if you haven't, sit down, let your mind go blank, and just start going. Go with one word, the next word, the next word. That's how it happens.
One emailer, songwriter, asks, if you feel guilty for taking credit when songs drop in that way.
You know, I would if I didn't spend a lot of my life trying to give back, but I don't, and I'm just grateful. I'm grateful that these songs dropped into me, and frankly, I'm very happy to be enjoying the financial benefits of it, but I also, from that too, give back. I would feel guilty if I didn't give back, but I don't. I do give back, so I don't feel guilty.
So what happens with all the revenues that come from all these songs? How do you find yourself living? How do you find yourself sharing?
Well, for one thing, I would mention the revenues to all songwriters, people who maybe haven't done as well as I've done, which is when you download illegally, you are taking money from the creator of a song. And I'm not going to complain because I have done really, really well. But, you know, somebody like, say, Tony Stern, who wrote It's Too Late and maybe hasn't had that many hits and depends upon that income. If you download, you're affecting her income. You're affecting the income of the first-time songwriter who, you know, depends on that income. So that's what I would say. As far as for myself, I have done really well, and I am so, so grateful. I try to live not wastefully. I can't say I live simply. Because, you know, I have a ranch in Idaho, and right there, that's not living simply. And I travel a lot, and, you know, I help fund organizations and stuff. But I try to live not wastefully.
At 7 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show.
Seems so hard. child and play out in the yard. I want to feel safe again. I don't know what happened to you. Where did you go? Wish I could not feel the cold wind blow. I want to feel.
And let's take a caller in Detroit, Michigan. Ilana, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Hi, Carol.
Hi.
Hi.
Such an honor to be able to listen to you both. It's quite inspiring. My question for Carol is, Carol, I spent part of my youth at boarding school in Idaho, and it's where I really grew and found myself. And part of that was through a lot of your music and the way that I interpreted the messages that you were trying to put out. And what I'm wondering is, if you could summarize one thing that you really want to teach us and get across to us, what would it be?
It is to stay connected to the highest parts of yourself in the sense of love. I know that everybody has experienced being hurt, and, you know, a lot of very angry people out there, you know, have been hurt and just want to let everybody know how angry they are. I think that if you put out love and you think along the high road and say, well, I can't control what somebody did to me, but I can control what I do, that's where the key lies, in my opinion. And just stay on the high road and put out good thoughts and be open. And don't be afraid of being hurt again, because if we don't put ourselves out there, we don't experience the good things.
Where were you on 9/11?
I was in New York on 9/11. And I was, I have an apartment that I keep uptown because I go there so much. It's near Columbia University. And so I wasn't near all the devastation, but I saw it on television. I have a daughter who lives in Brooklyn. She was on her way to work on the subway. It was a different subway than the one that was affected. But I was not at my ease until, you know, she called in and I said, walk north, come, you know, come here. But then I and my daughter and everybody else in New York, just after, you know, even while watching this devastation, is, oh my God, what can we do? And people almost literally rolled up their sleeves. We went to the hospital to see if we could give blood. That wasn't necessary. We volunteered to help. I went around with Congresswoman Maloney to talk to people, to reassure them that everything we could do was being done. It was an amazing time. The country did pull together. We got calls from all over. My congressman in Idaho said, today we're all New Yorkers.
Mm. And, of course, the French said, today we're all Americans.
Yes.
And yet we're still a divided country. We have lots of issues. But somehow, some way, music, your music, this kind of music, brings us together.
I hope so. I mean, when I write, I don't consciously sit down to say, I'm going to write a song that's going to bring everyone together. But I'm a person who wants to bring everyone together. I too, like the other Mr. King, the Rodney King, want to know, can't we all just get along?
Carole King. And her latest album is called Love Makes the World. Thanks for listening. Carole King, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Diane. You're a wonderful lady, and it's my honor to be here.
My pleasure. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Ray.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from Softscribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Make it
show.